Welcome to Boggo, the official podcast for historic Boggo Road Jail, recorded live inside its walls. I'm the director, Jack Sim. In each episode, we explore the history of Australia's most notorious prison.
Hello everyone, welcome to Boggo, Season 3, Episode 4. Today's episode, I'm going to be sharing with you a recording I made several years ago with a former prisoner. The man that will be joining us, Max C. Lee, is a former prisoner who was here at Boggo Road way back in the 1950s. And he talks about his time in prison, his involvement in some of the riots here at the jail, and trouble that happened in 1957. He's a great character and it's very entertaining. I hope you enjoy our episode today.
I'm glad you got in touch with me, Max. I loved your letter. I'm taking some notes and I just thought might go through, you know, your life and what sent you to Boggo Road, that sort of thing. Would you mind if I...
No, mate. I've always said the only person I really hurt was my dear mother, you know. But she worked the guts out for me. She sent me to Church of England Grammar at East Brisbane. She sent me to Church of England Grammar boarding school at Morpeth near Maitland. She went out of her way to see that I got her education, but I just didn't seem to be able to grasp what she wanted me to do, you know. She was only a battler, like she was a nurse, but she was only a battler. But as I say, I've never been ashamed of what I've done. What I did was my choice, and the only person I really hurt, I think, was my mother, you know.
How old were you when you went to Boggo Road, Max?
Well, first time I was not quite 18 was when I first got 12 months for a string of break and enters. And I went into the boys' yard, what they had then. You weren't allowed to mix with the blokes until you were at least 18 years of age. I think it was 2 or 3 years with a 12-month bond, which meant I had to serve the full 12 months, no remission. Then I was released on a 2-year bond or something like that, you know. Then I got into a bit of strife down. I went back to sea, merchant seaman, and I got into a bit of trouble there for stealing, and I got 9 months in Long Bay, and I ended up getting out what they call on licence at the time. I appealed against the 9 months because it was bloody severe. Even the magistrate that sentenced me, he said, "I'm sick and tired of you seamen coming to our city and think you can run the place, you know." So I was more or less a test example for him, you know. I got 9 bloody months, and I bloody hoisted the flag straight away. You know, I thought, geez, 9 months for this? I only got 12 months in Boggo Road for about 20 break and enters, you know, as a kid. They come to me cell, one, of course, New South Wales jails, different to Queensland. I found Queensland jails, I don't know about now, but they'd never had kicking squads like they got in down in New South Wales, you know. They're notorious for their kicking squads, you know. 2 or 3 screws would come into your cell and work you over, you know. When I was in Long Bay, I heard one of the screws say to one of the blokes who was causing a bit of trouble, "Keep this up and you'll be going to Grafton." So there was more or less a frightener. They reckoned at one stage there they had a great big butcher's block, huge, massive big thing put in the cell. And then they'd give you a bucket and a scrubbing brush and tell you to clean it, scrub the floor, and then about 3 screws would come in. It took that many to move it. And when they saw it was dry underneath, they'd give you a kicking for not doing the floor properly, you know. But Queensland... All the time I was in Queensland, all the trouble I got into, even up in Stewart Creek, there was never any strong arm stuff. New South Wales, because the night my licence come through, if you were caught up at your window at your cell talking to the bloke in the next slot, you automatically got a bit of a working over, you know. And I'd been talking to the bloke next door and he heard the keys coming along the landing and he yelled out, "Screws." So I jumped down and next minute, the cell door burst open, there's 2 of them. I thought, here we go, you know, they're going to give me a kicking for being up at me thing. But all it was, he said, "You Maxwell Peter George?" I said, "Yeah." And he had a sheaf of paper in his hand. And he said, "Your license has come through." This was about 10 o'clock at night. He said, "Have you got somewhere to stay?" I said, "No, not here in Sydney." I said, "I want to go back to Newcastle." He said, "Oh, well, stay the night and you'll be released first thing in the morning." And first thing in the morning, I was working in the bookbinding shop, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, and I thought, them bastards, they instead of giving me a kick and they've conned me, you know, thinking I'm going to be released. Sure enough, after about 10 or so, one of the guards come in, said something the bloke in charge of the shop, and he come and got me, and they released me on license.
I loved your letter, Max. It was what you said about you'd been watching the 1988 riots at Bogger Road, and in my book that I've written about the history of the jail, I'd fleshed out a bit of info about your time, and it was interesting what you had to say about that 88 riot, and I'd love to hear a bit about that. Can I just ask you, Max, in your letter you say in 1955 you got 6 years for robbery with violence, is that right?
Yeah, robbery was violence. There's three of us, we bloody worked a bloke out. A bloke that we thought had a briefcase full of diamonds, and it turned out the word we got was all bullshit, you know. We got drinking with him, and Amos Croxford was his name. I still remember the weird name he had. He was from Melbourne. And the word we got that he was a diamond traveller, and that the briefcase was full of diamonds. And a man should have had more sense. As though any bloke would be walking around, like when you're 18, 19, 20 years of age, or 21 I think I was, when you're that age, what bloke would be walking around Brisbane with a briefcase full of diamonds drinking in hotels, you know? Young and silly, we didn't think of that, and we just told him bullshit where we could get him some, put him onto a Sheila, and we took him down near the wharf somewhere and then bloody give him a hiding, and we got bloody 6 years. Three of us got 6 years each. And as I said, I would have been out in five for the sixth remission, but I ended up doing about 8.5 or 9, I think, all up. With the extra time I got, lost a remission on top of that, was a year. That was one of the reasons why we went on the hunger strike up in Townsville for 10 or 12 days, whatever it was because they brought in the new rule that any infringement, regardless of how minor, you automatically lost your remission. So this meant a bloke, say in my case, but then I still didn't have me 12 months remission then, but if I still hadn't lost it, bloody, that meant for not having a button done up or something, and I'm on an infringement notice, I could get 12 months for not having a button done up. Virtually turned out to me, you know. Or you know, if you had 6 months, you might back answer one of the guards. He might say, get into line. You might say, I'll get fucked or something like that, you know. And they report you, and you might get 2 days solitary or something like that on bread and water or half rations. For that minor, very minor offence, if you had 6 months remission, you're virtually not doing 2 or 3 days in the slot. You lost 2 weeks tobacco and 2 weeks on half rations. You also got extra 6 months back onto your sentence, I should say. So that's why we went on the hunger strike. And much as we tried, some of the bobbies up there, the guards up in towns were like most jails. You get your good and your bad. That's only natural. Same with the police force. You've got your good and the bad. But bloody, some of the good, decent ones that we could sit down and talk to, we tried to tell them to bloody get what we were going on a hunger strike to get word to the other rest of the jail, because we were segregated. We never mixed with anyone. And no one would go in on the hunger strike with us. And when it came over the news, I remember it was a Sunday night. It came over the news one Sunday night that the Act had been repealed and the remission would now be reinstated or whatever it was, you know. And you should have heard the kicking of the doors and the cheering. All the wings went off, you know. And I thought, yeah, mongrels, you know, you wouldn't go on hunger strike, but you don't mind getting the goodies out of it, you know.
Max, take me through the background to what led to the protest and the strike in 1957,
58. Yeah, well, mainly we got word on the grapevine that one of the blokes in the cookhouse, apparently he was the head cook, had ulcers on his legs or somewhere, and he was washing, the food at the time was absolute garbage, you know. For breakfast, we used to have a Dixie full of mush, or porridge as they call it, with a lid on it with baked beans sitting in it. And the baked beans were a pale pink. They were atrocious bloody things. They must have got them by the bagful and cooked them in the kitchen. I don't know, but they weren't manufactured stuff from a factory, not by the look of them. That was bad enough. There was a lot of grumbling going on about the meals and the bloody stew that you'd get. You couldn't bloody eat. The meat was bloody all gristle and fat. And anyhow, then we got word that the bloke in the kitchen was boiling his bandages in one of the saucepans on the stove. It was the straw that broke the camel's back, you know. We just barricaded in. Was in the A-wing at the time, up top. I was in number 52, second from the end on the top landing on the right-hand side as you went up. It was quite ironical, Jack, because you'd think it was made to measure. The steel bed faced lengthwards up against the back wall, and your pine table at the end of the bed fit snugly against the door. And, mate, it was like the old proverb of getting an egg standing on its end and trying to break it. You'll never break it, you know, while it's standing perfectly on its end, pushing on it. It's only when you turn it sideways you break it. And it was a case of that. No matter how hard they shouldered the door and tried to hit it, there's no way in the world they could budge it. And we're in there for about 3 or 4 days. And Eventually, one of the bobbies that ended up getting transferred up to Stewart Creek as superintendent, he came up with the bright idea with a big rafter across the width of the, from one side of the other cell block to the other, with a 10-ton jack up against the wall, and of course it just shattered the table being pine. It just shattered. And so then they put me downstairs in the bottom cell, and the wing and A-wing at Bogger Road, it used to go up onto the top landing, and when you got onto the first landing, you had like step off to go onto the landing, and then it went up straight up onto the top landing, and they had these two like rafter struts underneath the stairs. There's only support. There's no way in the world that could break or come down, but I just added there as a support, you know. And anyhow, I'm in there one night, and at the time they had a lot of short timers, drunks and that, sleeping out on the floor in the cell, in the wing. And I yelled out to one of the blokes, I said, grab one of them bloody posts or rafters things, pass it through. So it just fitted through the top of the door where you put your hand out or anything, you know. And I barricaded in again. So they had to get the 10-ton jack again and get me out again. After 3 or 4 days in there, bloody, they come one night about 8:30. They said, Mr. Rutherford, the Comptroller General of Prisons, wants to see you. And I thought, holy fucking hell, what's going on here, you know? And they took me across, and they're sitting there in the office with my bloody uncle, and who helped raise me. And he started to lecture me on the differences between peacetime and wartime, what they had to go through during the war, what we're going through, you know? And I just said to him, I said, you can't compare it, you know, there's no reason for us to be treated like we're treated, you know, the food, the bloody, like washing these bandages in the bloody, what we get. I know they were boiled, but it still turns psychologically, you know, it's in your mind that you could be eating something with these baldy, bloody, ulcer-ridden bloody bandages in, plus various other things, you know, there's bloody minor things that are just, minor things on their own, it wouldn't have mattered. But bloody, they just seemed to stack on top of one another before it came to her. And I don't know, even know who suggested the barricade or how come it, but just flared up.
Can I ask you, Max, when you're in Boggo in the 50s, were Aboriginal men separated from you guys?
No. One of my best mates, Lenny Cunningham was his name. There was four of them came in, and I lived down at Deegan or Sandgate at one stage. And that's where they came from. And then they got 7 years each, the four of them. Lenny was an Aborigine, probably half caste or quarter caste, I don't know. But no, there's nothing like that. We still mixed together, you know. A psychiatrist would have a field day, I should say, because there's always your cliques. Three or four blokes here, three or four blokes there, and they're all more or less the same sort of bloke knockabouts, bloody made their living through thieving or, you know, that sort of thing. They're all tarred with the one brush, and then you'd have your other groups where they might be just drunks or something like that, or vags or things like this, you know. But I often thought a psychiatrist, if he could go in there in disguise as a psychiatrist, went in as a criminal, you had all your little cliques around the yard with different blokes. You could always pick the knockabouts, what we call decent blokes, you know, and then you had your dogs, blokes that had run information to the screws if they could, or if they had anything on you, they kept to themselves virtually, you know.
Do you remember, Max, what was your standard sort of meals in a day? Do you remember? I know you said the food was bad, but what would a typical menu be like?
Well, breakfast is always the same. Plate of mush, and you got your milk. Anyone serving a long sentence got issued with a little bag of dry tea and a little bag of sugar. And you put your pannikin out in front of your door when you come out of your cell, and the sweeper who was in charge of that landing, he'd come around just before you come in for your lunch with a big canister full of so-called boiling water. And you just put your tea leaves in the bottom of it. You just pour the tea. The bloody pannikin was about a litre size, big copper one or brass one it was. And those that didn't have tea or sugar, they just got the ready-made tea. But yeah, that was the breakfast, and just as bad. It was always bloody stew. I think the only time we looked forward to anything was bloody Christmas time, and when they seemed to put on a bit of edible, something that was edible, you know. Second time I got into trouble for assaulting one of the guards was, I still remember his name. His name was Venerables. The bloke behind me in the queue saw me take the lid off and put it down, just pick me mush up. And when we walked into the wing, he said, "Don't you eat your baked beans?" I said, "Oh, I can stick them up their ass, mate." I said, "I'm not going to eat them." He said, "Oh, I'll have them." I said, "Oh, you can have them." So he was in the cell opposite me. And so I just walked up and I took two steps into his cell just to put it on his table. And I walked out, walked in, shut my door. In those days, you had to put your hand up through the grill. I'm standing there with my hand above the door, waiting for him to lock the door. This venerable next minute, the door's pushed up against me, made me step back. I thought, fuck, what's going on here? And he come in and he said, you had no right to go into the prisoner's cell. And I told him why I did. He said, doesn't matter. He said, you're not allowed to go into a prisoner's cell. The regulations state. And he started going on. And I said, all right, you've told me, or something like that, you know. And I turned to go to my table, and he followed me and started tapping me on the shoulder. And that was it. I turned around and hung one on him, you know. And I had to front the magistrate over that. And as I said, about every 3 months, you were allowed to have a buy-up. And you could spend 30 shillings, which was $6, whatever, equivalent. And tobacco, you got 2 ounces, which is, what, 50 gram, once a week. Mum always sent me in Log Cabin or State Express or something like that. You could have your tobacco sent in with 2 books of papers and a box of matches. You could have sent in from outside. But I tried everything, you know, when I'd run out of tobacco, I got the knife on my pine table and run the edge of it along until I got a heap of bloody sawdust. I rolled it in a bit of toilet paper and tried to smoke that. Bloody hell, you know. When I look back on it, as I said in the letter, that those blokes thought the conditions were bad in 88. They should have been there 50 years earlier. Georgie Potter got up on the roof before we put the barricades on. This was a couple of weeks before. And when I watched the thing on the video that my friends had got, that mentioned the blokes on the roof, they were throwing tennis balls of water up to them. And all the blokes in the yard screamed out because he was running along to catch them, and they threw one up, and he's looking up in the air running, and he bloody nearly run off the end of A-wing. So when I say nearly run off, he was running towards the end, and the blokes down in the yard started to scream out, George, George, look out, look out. And he stopped. Well, I don't say he run off, but he was probably about 2 or 3 metres from the end because he was that concentrating on the ball in the air that he wasn't watching where he's running, you know.
I think I understand, but can I just get you to explain again what you did in your cell? You took the bed and sort of turned it sideways in the cell and then put the table in there as well to create like a wedge so they couldn't get the door open.
Yeah, you pushed the bed, so the bed head or the foot of the bed was against the back wall where the window was, and so it's in the centre of your cell, running the length of your cell.
Right.
And that left a gap of exactly... The pine table would have been about a metre high, or close to it, I suppose, and about a metre wide, I forget. But then you slid the table in, you had to jam it in there between the end of the bed and the steel door. And, mate, you didn't have a half inch. It was wedged.
you wrote in your letter, you said you not only did you get that extra time, but you did 14 days in the black hole, the Black Peter. Can you tell me a bit about that and what it was like?
Well, the Black Peter in B Wing, 3/4 of the way along, you had a long, like a huge door, but it was laying down on the wing floor. And they lifted that up, and you had stairs going down. And down at the bottom of the stairs, there was 2 cells, left and right. And that's what they called the Black Peter. And they put you in there. The one in Brisbane wasn't completely dark, but it was too dark to read or anything like that, you know. While I was down there, they brought a lay preacher down. And he handed me a little Bible. And he said, now, son, I want you to read this. I said, I'm not a fucking owl. And the screw that was there said, hey, George, what's your language, you know? And I said, well, I said, I'm not an owl. How am I supposed to read this in the Black Peter? But the one in Townsville, because I'd done about 6 days down there, I was doing 14 days, then they shipped us off up to Townsville, and I had to finish the 8 days in Townsville. And the one in Townsville, mate, you couldn't see your hand in front of you. It was bread and water in those days in the Black Peter. So they gave me the pannikin full of water and a half a loaf of bread. And I just stuck it in the corner. And after a few hours, I thought, I'll have a bit of bread. And I picked it up and I'm chewing it and feel all these crawly things. The fucking thing was saturated in ants. I was chewing bloody more ants than I was bread, you know.
In your letter, you wrote about how you were released in December 63. So did they bring you back? Like, as a prisoner, did you come back from Townsville to Boggo Road and then release from Boggo Road?
So, superintendent, the bloke that got the job, I think, over the Jacks, he bloody called me down. He said, you're due for release. I think it was Christmas week. I knew Mum was coming up. She told me. He said, you've got 2 options, George. He said, one, you put on the train under police escort. And I said, well, what's that fucking prove? I said, I can get off the next station. He said, I'm just telling you. He said, that's the stipulation. He said, oh, your mother picks you up at 6:30 at the front gate. I said, well, Mum's coming up to pick me up. I more or less embarrassed him more than anything. He said, oh, well, no hard feelings. And he put his hand out and I spat on him. Spat on his bloody hand. Not spit, I just went like that, you know. Get him out of here, get him out of here. And as they took me out, one of the screws said to me, you're Max, you're bloody mad. You know, he could have charged you with assault then. He said, your mother's coming all the way up from Brisbane. He said, he could have had you charged for what you just did. And I said, well, I wasn't going to shake hands with him, you know.
In the 50s, what was your uniform you wore?
Just a pair of grey shorts and a grey shirt. No underpants, no singlets.
What did you wear on your feet in those days?
We had boots, but we never used to wear them because all the other crims were locked up at 4 o'clock or whatever time it was. They'd come and get us last and take us in. We'd just be barefooted.
I write books about true crime and such. In the 1950s, when you were, you know, involved in robbery and everything, can you describe to me what the crime scene and the police was like in Brisbane in that era?
Those days, of course, Jack, they never had computers. And you always knew you were going to get a working over when they took you in the office and they started picking the typewriters up and taking them out of the office. You might have two or three desks in there. And you'd see them, you'd be sitting there, and one would pick up a typewriter and walk out, another would pick up a in case you couldn't get hold of it and throw the fucking thing out the window or throw it at them, you know. You knew it was coming. And there'd always be one standing behind you. Now tell us what happened. Nothing happened back. Slap open hand or across the back of the fucking head, you know. They always made sure it wasn't closed fist in the face or anything, you know. But they'd work you over. That's why it always amuses me when you see these crime shows, whether they're English or Australian. You hear them say, be careful what you say to this prisoner because he might get upset. I thought, you get upset, you get a fucking hiding. You know, that was the accepted thing, you know.
When you were involved in robbery and such, were there sort of mates that you did this with regularly, or was it that sophisticated, or was it more opportunistic, like?
More opportunist, Jack. My best mate, buddy, he was fighting 6-rounders at the time. I didn't know this. Ray Oliver was his name. This is when I'd done about 15 or 20 break and enters. I used to go into this milk bar in Brisbane. I was only 18 or something. It's this gorgeous little sort working behind the counter. And I was madly in love with her. And there was always these three young blokes sitting in one of the booths. Anyhow, one night she said, I don't know whether I can go out with you. You'll have to ask me boyfriend. And I said, oh, shit, who's your boyfriend? She said, that fella's sitting at the booth. And he was quite good-natured about it, you know. I just tried to ask your girl out. He said, no, she's with me, mate, you know. Anyhow, sit down. We've got talking, and silly me, 18 years of age. He said, what do? You never work? He said, we see you around all the time. I said, oh, I break into places, mate. I said, I get money, you know. He said, oh, can I come with you? And I said, if you want to. So he became my partner. So he came along with me. And being young and stupid, that's how I come undone. I broke into this news agent. In those days, you had no such thing as cameras or alarms or anything like that in the 50s, you know. You might have the odd alarm, but very rare. There used to be a pen out called Parker 51 that was the top fountain pen. It was the best pen on the market at the time. And this news agent had a stack of them. I'd take them to this hock shop down near the valley. And I walked in and I said to the bloke behind the counter, I said, are you interested in these? And he said, oh, I'm not, mate. He said, my brother buys them. He said, can you come back at 1 o'clock? So what's idiot me do? I come back at 1 o'clock. and he's, there's this bloke standing behind the counter. He's a jack, a detective. I said, are you his brother? He said, yeah. He said, what do you want for these pens? I said, what are they worth? He said, I'll tell you what they're worth, probably 6 months. I said, what? And I turned around to go out, and he had another jet that was waiting outside, pretended to be walking outside. And he come walking in with that poor old bloody Ray by the one cuff on his hand. And they cuffed us. And I learned later, I mean, as soon as the bloke said, I don't deal him, he'd come back in an hour or 1 o'clock. I should have waked him, but because it's a known fact that all pawnbrokers, I know they accept hot goods, a lot of them, but all of them do now and then keep their tally good by putting someone in, you know. And it makes them look good in front of the coppers. At least getting the coppers are getting a pinch now and then out of it, you know. Even though they might turn a blind eye to some of the goings on in some of the pawn shops, you know.
What was it like to be a teenager in this time period, you know? Like,
I grew up in the age of the bodgies and the witches. In those days, they used to have what they call jazz concerts. Might be at Newcastle Town Hall or somewhere, and you'd go there, and they'd have pommy bands, like Dixieland jazz bands, Australian ones. There used to be a singer called Edwin Duff. He'd get out on stage, and I remember one night, first time I ever heard him, he come out on stage and he said, well, I'm going to sing a bit of a respectful song now. And he started singing, "We'll Sing Matilda." He sung a first bit of it, and blokes are saying, "Shit, what's this he's singing?" And he's singing it in the real slow, modern, how it's supposed to be sung. And then he stopped and then he said, "Matilda, Matilda." And the drummer's hitting the drums as he's doing it. And then off he goes in the swing version of "We'll Sing Matilda" with the jazz band behind him. But that was mainly what you, as you lived your life as a bodgie, you just lived for the weekend.
I was just looking through some of my notes. Back in 57, when Georgie Potter and Gallagher went up on the roof, apparently a few weeks before they went up on the roof, there was some trouble and there was a bloke, William John Taylor.
That's the bloke in the cell, 24 hours 7. And I was telling him, I got a gauze door, came out.
Yep.
That's him, Taylor.
Gotcha.
Yeah, because he was the bloke, he's in C Wing, down as you walked in the door, he was on the left-hand side, had a steel door, which was never shut, but he had this steel gauze door, you could see through it. He was in there. When I first went in there, I said, what's that bloke never comes out? Because you used to have to line up muster of a morning, as you know. And you could see him laying in bed or sitting at his table. I said to one of the blokes, I said, what the fuck with him? I said, how come he doesn't have it? He said, oh, he doesn't come out. He's in there all the time. He's a bit of a troublemaker, they reckon. When the second time I barricaded in, they had a very small yard that had the shower and the wash basin in there and the toilet. And it was a tiny little yard, it was. And they stuck me in there on my own, in solitary confinement. I'm in there one day, and apparently, unbeknownst to me, when he did want exercise, Taylor, they used to take him down, put him in this little yard. Anyhow, as I said, Mum used to send me in tobacco. She used to send me in Log Cabin. Well, I don't know whether you know anything about tobacco, but Log Cabin was what they call fine cut. It was in flakes. And whenever you wanted to smoke, you used to have to put a bit of the flake in your hand and rub it.
Rub it, yeah.
Anyhow, I'm sitting there this day and the gate opens. I look around and there's Billy Taylor. He's joking. He said, hey, you, what are you doing in my fucking yard? This is my fucking yard. He's laughing, you know. And I said, "G'day, what are you doing?" He said, "This is my yard." And I said, "Oh, is this where you come?" He said, "Yeah, this is my yard. This is where I've been coming for years. This is the only yard they'll let me have." He sat down, and where I'd been rubbing the tobacco in my hand, a couple of tiny little grain of bloody tobacco must have fallen on the concrete. And they call it grouse tobacco in there. You got grouse. And he sat down, he looked down, he said, "Oh, you got grouse tobacco." And I said, "Fuck, how do you know?" He said, "There." And he pointed to the ground. There's this little grain of tobacco, like fine cut, sitting under concrete, that he knew I didn't have boob tobacco. I said, "Do you want one?" He said, "Oh, yeah, can I have one?" But yeah, that was the only time I had that. One afternoon or one morning, I forget when it was now, but he was there for a couple of hours, and they said, "Come on, Taylor, back to your cell." Took him back, and then they took me back later.
Do you remember when you're in Boggo in the 50s, were there any other notorious names or characters you remember from that era?
Other bloke I knew was when I was in Long Bay, was I'd been up on about 3 murder charges. He ended up getting 5 years. Coppers said they found a piece in his glove box. Like a man of his ability and knowledge would not have been driving around in a car with a piece in the glove box, you know, because they knew it automatically carried 5 years for conviction. A known criminal carrying a gun was automatic 5 years. He was too smart. They reckon it was a plan that the coppers put it in the glove box and said that they would charge you with this gun, you know. And Joey Holliman was his name. And I was standing in the yard one day and these 3 blokes walked past and one of the blokes said to me, not these 3, one of the blokes in the yard, said, "Oh, there's Joey Holliman." And I saw these 3 blokes. And I said, "Which one?" And the bloke in the middle, mate, he would have been about 5'2". He said, "There, oh, there." I said, "Where?" They said, "The bloke in the middle." I said, "That little bloke?" I said, "That's Joey Holliman." They said, "Yeah, that's him." I said, "Fuck." So I said, "I was expecting some mountain of a bloke about 6'2", you know, because he had the reputation as a known gunman in Sydney at the time. They reckon he went to a party one time and pulled out a gun and shot about 3 people at a party, shot the poor girl that was up on the stage or up on a raised platform singing. someone dropped the gun, got rid of it. He got charged, but they could never, no one would give evidence against him. The woman ended up killing him in his sleep, they reckon, stabbed him while he was asleep.
Wow.
Yeah, he got his just desserts, I suppose they'd say, or the relatives of the people he killed, that is.
Mm. Well, hey, Max, I might finish up. When I got your letter, I was absolutely blown away. I knew about your riot in that era. It is as significant to the story of Bogger Road as the bigger ones in the 80s. Thanks a lot, mate. I appreciate it. It's been really good.
Okay, mate. Yes, same to you, Jack. All the best.
Bye, mate.
Escape the 21st Century. Book a tour at boggeroadjail.com. For more content, join us on TikTok, YouTube, Facebook and Instagram. We look forward to locking you up.